This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest today is, once again, Miles Traphagen. He's the Borderlands Program Coordinator for the Wildlands Network, working out of Tucson, Arizona. Hey, how long have you been with Wildlands Network, Miles?
Well, I've been with Wildlands Network for 7.5 years now.
Uh-huh. You've all of that time been in Tucson?
Yeah, I've been in Tucson the whole time, and then prior to that, I've been working along the borderline and the borderlands of New Mexico and Arizona since, the late 90s now.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to kind of say that time period. I realize it's been a long time, but you know, I've seen the ups and downs of the border and the different sort of eras of it. And to be honest, the progression has not been good. And I wish our leaders could have looked towards a kinder, gentler borderlands, but it doesn't appear to be that way.
Yeah. Well, as Borderlands Program Coordinator, what's your major responsibility?
Well, I was specifically hired after Trump won because there was the threat of a border wall.
Uh-huh.
So, sure enough, there was. It was 458 miles of border wall built under Trump. And so my job was to do what we could to try to stop the construction. But then, you know, that's a very difficult endeavor given the extraordinary powers that Congress has ceded over to the executive branch on those type of issues. So for several years, I've been trying to mitigate the damage, and specifically with things like wildlife openings and crossings in the border wall so that a variety of species, large and small, have the ability to migrate and get through.
So 70 organizations sent a letter to the Army Corps of Engineers and Homeland Security, I guess in regard to the border wall. Has that communication ever been responded to?
What year was that? Was that the recent letter or one a couple of years back?
I think it was the recent letter.
Okay. Yeah, there's very little dialogue. You know, there's no shortage of sign-on letters and petitions. But to be honest, those are fairly ineffective in the face of the extraordinary powers that the Department of Homeland Security has.
Yeah.
And if I could line that out really quickly, how that is the case is that the Real ID Act of 2005, Section 102, was a clause that enabled the Secretary of Homeland Security, who is an unelected politically appointed official, to waive all laws for the construction of border barriers. And this includes everybody's favorite environmental or cultural protection law, such as the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Golden Eagle, Bald Eagle Protection Act, Native American Antiquities, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow.
So in a very poor moment of judgment, in my opinion, Congress gave away a lot of authority to acts that were established going back to 1892, the Rivers and Harbors Protection Act, which were, you know, keep in mind, they were passed by both houses of Congress, signed into law by the president, and then surviving decades of judicial review. To allow one person to annul all of those laws, and it takes quite a bit for a bill to get enacted and passed, is quite an extraordinary ceding of power by Congress to the executive branch, and a very poor moment of judgment in their part.
Mm-hmm. So, is the area that you're observing or responsible for, is that extend from El Paso all the way over to the California coast?
Yeah, I would say that my beat, as you would call it, would be the Rio Grande to the Pacific Ocean.
Uh-huh.
And that, what's unique about that is that there's a strip of land 60 feet wide called the Roosevelt Reservation, which was established by, ironically, you know, Theodore Roosevelt. So what a coincidence. But he did that in 1907, and that was to allow the federal government to have an easement so that they have access along the border. And this follows the lands that were obtained by the United States under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And so, you know, from Sunland Park, New Mexico, where Border Monument 1 was established in 1890, going to the Pacific Ocean, Tijuana and San Diego, by 1894, they put up 268 obelisks that all range in size from about 5 feet high to 7 or 8 feet, depending on where they're located. And these, this was the demarcation of the border line, the U.S.-Mexico border, for a long time.
How far apart are those obelisks?
They're not a set distance. They're in line of sight.
Ah.
So the theory is that if you're standing at one border monument, you should be able to look left or right, east, west, or north, south, if you happen to be on that boot heel of New Mexico axis, and you can see an obelisk on both sides. Therefore, just by triangulation, you can see I'm on the line. Because, you know, this predates, you know, barbed wire fencing for the most part. So that's how it was marked. And if you're ever down in the borderlands, it's really worth taking a trip to see some of these because they've been around for a long time, and they have an inscription on one side. If you're in Mexico, it reads English, that this is the boundary of the United States of America.
Uh-huh.
If you're in the U.S., it reads the opposite, and it says, you know, El límite de los Estados Unidos y, you know, Estado de México, you know, on the other side.
Uh-huh.
And then they're numbered all on the east side of the monument. So you have a progression of numbers that go from 1 to, I believe it's 256. Even though there's 268 monuments, there's several in New Mexico that are like Monument 7A, Monument 7B. And what they did is these were added in because they realized that with the prevailing technology of field glasses at the time, they wouldn't be able to see these monuments adequately. So they added a few in when there was some discrepancies there.
What's the border wall in relationship to those line-of-sight obelisks?
Well, the border wall sits on the north side of these. And so, unfortunately, you can't really stand next to very many of them. There's still quite a few that are standalone. I think the coolest one is Monument 40, and that is at the corner of the boot heel of New Mexico, west of Columbus, New Mexico, and Denning. And it's where there's a north-south axis of the border that runs north-south, and then it intersects with the east-west axis.
Mm.
And so Monument 40 is a really good one. It's one of the most robust ones I've seen, probably 8 feet tall, painted, very bright white, and it's just in a really picturesque place that is in a location on the border that's unique. And that's very easily accessible on public land, BLM land. At least it has been, and we don't know how that's going to look here in the future because of recent developments regarding the transfer of BLM lands over to Department of Defense, the U.S. Army,
just
occurred in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, so the president has designated that strip as a military fort, and that gives the military jurisdiction to apprehend any people who are in that strip. How wide is the strip itself?
Well, it's pretty wide. It's up to about 3.5 miles in locations. Yeah, so they have extended this beyond the 60-foot Roosevelt Reservation all the way up to far north. I'll walk you through Sunland Park and the New Mexico side where the Rio Grande is.
Mm.
It is all the land south of Highway 9, and Highway 9 is a two-lane highway that goes east-west across New Mexico. It's a New Mexico State Highway.
Mm-hmm.
And for about 70 miles, everything south of that will be under military control. The dominant land ownership is Bureau of Land Management, and then there are New Mexico state land parcels. Whether New Mexico it will be challenging this to see if they can get access to their state lands remains to be seen. But there's also a lot of private lands and ranches and associated leases that are in this zone as well.
Well, do those private lands go right up to the border?
Yep, a lot of them go right up, right all the way up to the border. You know,
so
right to the edge of the Roosevelt Reservation.
So is there a legal challenge to establishing fort property on private land?
Not yet, but there is an act that was passed in Congress, it says that the executive branch can only transfer 5,000 acres to Department of Defense without an act of Congress. The Roosevelt Reservation happens to be 4,956 acres along its entire 658-mile strip. I'm sure that the act was no accident, that they said, okay, that's about 5,000 acres.
Uh-huh.
And if you're a GIS mapping person, projections make a big difference. So if you use NAD 83, 27, WGS 84, et cetera, you may end up with different acreages within just, you know, a margin of error. But suffice to say that 5,000 acres was what they put in that act. And I believe the spirit of the law was probably in regard to the acreage that existed in the Roosevelt Reservation.
Mm-hmm. Have they already deployed military personnel into that strip zone?
Not a lot. People are reporting seeing these Stryker vehicles, you know, along the border in places. And in fact, just a couple weeks ago, right after they put out this memorandum, the Secretary of Interior, there were two Marines who were killed in a car crash in New Mexico and one in critical condition. So pretty much on day one of the deployment, they had casualties right away. So that's really unfortunate because you know, I read the news and it was a civilian vehicle, meaning that it was probably a rental vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
I see National Guard soldiers and Marines in these rental vehicles a lot. And you know, people, they get driving too fast along these washboardy roads and, you know, terrain that can be very challenging.
Are these
paved? Get themselves in trouble.
Are these paved roads?
No, the Roosevelt Reservation is mostly dirt, with the exception of there's been a lot of paving done in the steep areas over the last 3 years, because many of these border walls were built in land that was too steep to support a lot of structures and a lot of cutting into roads, and so they were getting big gullying and erosion in certain areas, and so they've had to go back and pave these roads in order to keep them serviceable.
So is that distance between the Rio Grande or El Paso over to California, is that 658 miles?
Yeah, I believe that's the distance. You know, you get these numbers kind of mixed up in your head. Am I thinking 658 miles of border wall, or am I thinking this? It's about that.
But are there sections? Are there sections of the border where there's no border wall at the present time?
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, there's in New Mexico, starting at Monument One, there's 99.1 miles of border wall that continue to Monument 40.
Uh-huh.
And then just south of Monument 40, there's about 70 miles where there's no border wall on that north-south axis.
Uh-huh.
And then you've got 6 miles on Antelope Wells border crossing down on the Chihuahua-New Mexico border. And then another 30 or so before you hit the Arizona border. And then at Arizona, you get 70 miles of border wall that goes from Guadalupe Canyon through San Bernardino National Wildlife Refuge all the way up to Coronado National Memorial. And then we've got some gaps there, and then it resumes for, you know, 20 miles or so when you get around Nogales and another 20, and skips over 63 miles of the Tohono O'odham Reservation where there's just vehicle barrier. And then there's about another 70-plus miles of border wall at Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge and the Barry Goldwater Gunnery Range.
Uh-huh.
So that's essentially the lay of the land in Arizona, New Mexico. And then when you get to California, it's easier to actually name the places that don't have border wall, and that would be about 7 or 8 miles in the Jacumbo Wilderness area, another 2 miles that they didn't wall off, and then another 5 or 6. But other than that, California is nearing almost being completely walled off from Baja California Norte and the deserts there, which is quite unfortunate because the peninsular desert bighorn sheep lives there and crosses the border at that crest.
Mm-hmm.
as well as populations of mountain lion and mule deer, which, you know, migrate north and south along that crest of mountains that essentially goes from the central part of Baja California to up the Sierra Nevada, ultimately connecting to the Cascades. So, you know, we're looking at a situation where the continent is being walled off from millennia of migration routes that species have traveled and have imprinted in their genetic ecological memory.
So what I wanted to ask you is, what are the most egregious problems with the wall that's been built so far? What stands out?
Well, it's the lack of ability for wildlife to move and find the resources that they need.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, anybody who's been down here in the borderlands knows that it's an arid region. It's not a desert wasteland like most people think. It's an unfortunate illusion that's been cast that, you know, somehow we're just out here and blowing sand and nothing living. It's quite the opposite. The Sky Islands region of Arizona, New Mexico, where I live, has some of the highest biodiversity on the continent. There are more lizards species that occur in the Peloncillo Mountains of New Mexico right on the border than any other place on the continent. We have a jaguar reaching their northern range here. The ocelot, another spotted cat, a little small one that probably everybody would love to have one in their house. But and then we have black bears. And so the black bear reaches its southern limit when you're getting into northern Sonora and Chihuahua. What I like to say is that this is where the tropics and the temperate zones converge, and it's the black bear and the jaguar share the same trail. And that's a really unique trait of the borderlands, is the convergence of the Sonoran Desert, Chihuahuan Desert, Rocky Mountains, Sierra Madre, and all the associated biotic communities that occur in this area.
Are there particular species that have been blocked as opposed to species that are still able to cross the border?
Yeah, anything large has been blocked. And that's... I'll describe quickly how the border wall, what the border wall is.
Right.
It ranges in size from 18 feet tall to 30 feet tall, depending on when it was built. Everything prior to 2017 was 18-foot border wall, and now it's been 30-foot border wall. The spaces between the steel beams, which they call bollards, is only 4 inches. So, you know, you can picture that, you know,
these
nothing
are,
larger.
These are vertical beams, right?
Vertical beams, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And it's referred to as pedestrian fencing, which means to stop pedestrian traffic, not to facilitate it. And then it's these, they call these bollard walls. And bollard is actually, it comes from a nautical term. A bollard is one of those big iron round things that usually about 2 or 3 feet tall that you would find at a pier somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you would wrap your lines around that as you're mooring up a large vessel. And then there's like a little knob on that that's called the Norbin that sticks out to keep the rope from sliding off of that. Of course, you know, I know this because I spent several years in the Coast Guard and so nautical background.
Mm-hmm.
But so the bollards, that comes from a nautical perspective. But the fencing, they call bollard fencing. And there's only 4 inches spacing between these steel beams.
Right.
These square steel beams, which are, it's called cold steel tubing, ASTM 500, 3/8-inch thickness. So these have engineering standards to them. Anybody can look this sort of stuff up. So technical terms, carbon steel. But so wildlife don't have much opportunity to get through these on the larger end.
What species are able to slip through those vertical beams?
Well, last year we published a paper in Frontiers in Ecology demonstrating what we had observed passing through the border wall. And this was a result of our trail camera studies in southeastern Arizona.
Uh-huh.
Specifically the San Bernardino National Wildlife Refuge, and then places in the San Rafael Valley, and then the San Pedro River. So we found that there's many species that can pass through these small spaces.
Mm-hmm.
It's just common sense what you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
But in some places, specifically the San Bernardino National Wildlife Refuge, there are a series of small wildlife passages, is what they're called by Homeland Security. And these, we call them doggy doors because they're 8.5 by 11 inches.
Uh-huh.
So pretty small. But to our surprise, female mountain lions and their kittens were able to pass through these.
Uh-huh.
It's remarkable to see this. Javelina, which is peccary, which is the wild pig down here, a lot of them can get through, not the big males.
No kidding.
Same thing
wow.
with the doggy doors, the large male mountain lions you can observe getting through there. But, you know, any large species, we're talking bighorn sheep, pronghorn deer, whether it's coos white-tailed deer or the mule deer, they can't pass through here. There's no chance that they're going to make it.
What about Mexican wolves?
Mexican wolves would not be able to make it through that.
Okay. Coyotes?
And that's been demonstrated, too.
Coyotes?
Coyotes can get through some stuff occasionally. What we've discovered is that there are some anomalies in border wall construction where some of the workmanship was, you know, it wasn't always perfect, you know. There's, you know, nearly 3 million steel bollard posts out there along the 458 miles of pedestrian fencing. There's some places where the gaps might be 15 to 18 centimeters wide, which is, you know, about 6 inches.
Uh-huh.
And the standard would be, you know, 10 or 11 inches. And they can take advantage of just that extra little bit of space to get through. In fact, I checked some of our trail cameras in New Mexico about 10 days ago and was surprised to see that, you know, a coyote was able to wiggle through that 18-centimeter gap. There was a great video of a badger that came through. Made it through that. To underscore some of the observations and outcomes of our study, which was done in conjunction partnership with Sky Island Alliance, a conservation group here in Tucson, Arizona, we're trying to influence policy on a very specific nuts and bolts level.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you make design modifications? You know, can you space them at 18 centimeters apart versus 10, so that we're able to get, you know, 86% of the species that occur in the borderlands to be able to cross?
Yeah.
And so can we work on other things with floodgates or larger wildlife openings, which could be monitored through electronic means, so that, you know, they have the opportunity to cross as well.
So in the design and the planning of these border walls, was there deliberate, were there deliberate features provided for some wildlife at least to get through?
Yeah, the 8x11 small wildlife passages, they were incorporated in the design back in 2020. So they put those in there at the request of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Uh-huh.
So they happen to occur mostly in refuge properties that are along the border. But there's a few in the national forest, not very many. Problem is that they're very clustered and that we've got, you know, less than a dozen openings at San Bernardino Refuge in a span of 2.5 miles along the border. And then there's nothing. And so, you know, picture this that, you know, it's another 20 miles to the New Mexico border where it stops after the refuge. And so any animal going out that way wouldn't be able to cross for 20 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And then going to the west towards the Huachuca Mountains and Coronado National Memorial, you've got another 50 miles of border wall. So they're really restricted where they have crossing opportunities.
Yeah.
And if we are able to get more of these at regular spaced intervals, so that we provide wildlife across the border greater opportunities for passage. That would be just wonderful.
So when let's say, a wolf or a jaguar bumps up against the fence, I've seen a picture of this happening. Do they go in some direction, either east or west, to try to find a way through, or do they eventually give up? Have you noticed any behavior that the results from the frustration of not being able to pass?
Well, yeah, we've seen all of the above. We've had videos where a black bear paces back and forth for 12 hours before it finally gives up.
Really?
With GPS satellite collar data, a Mexican wolf in 2021 paced along the border wall in New Mexico for 3 days and finally gave up and just rested for a couple and went back up to the Gila wilderness where it originated from. And this was one that had a GPS satellite collar on it, part of the Mexican Gray Wolf Recovery Program, the U.S. unit. So we have those data points that show that, yeah, this animal went back and forth. And then prior to that, in 2017, there was the wolf who came out of Chihuahua prior to a border wall, did a 600-mile journey in 32 days, spent 3 days in Las Cruces, a couple days in El Paso, and then crossed back down across the border and went back to the mountains in Chihuahua. So, you know, it was able to express its dispersal instincts, both of these male wolves, of course, and then ironically, that's not even the right word, but through some amazing coincidence or ecological cue, the wolf in 2021 that they called Mr. Goodbar came within 100 meters of one of the points that pinged for Wolf 1425 back in 2017. And if you go to this area, it's Chihuahuan desert grassland. You know, it's wide open, volcanic landfields with this dry desert grassland. You know, nothing around, no streams, rivers, springs. And, I plugged in the GPS points and went and visited those in 2017 and then went back in 2021 to see the second wolf. And I just couldn't believe that somehow a wolf 200 miles south of the border, that far away from a wolf north of the border in the Gila wilderness, why did they converge within 100 meters of that same point? And, you got to be a scientist to say, oh, it's just a data point of one and of one. We can't say anything about it. It's just coincidence, stuff like that. But sometimes you got to take off your science hat and just be in awe of nature to say that there's something that they're cluing in on that we don't understand, and it's a wonderful thing.
Well, Miles, I hate to interrupt, but we've run out of time, and I have a lot more to ask you. So perhaps we can continue this conversation next week. So thanks very much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. So this has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association of Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found at its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.